This is the Book Club at 91.7. I'm Mark Purcell. Glad to have you along this morning. The Happiest People in the World is the new novel from Brock Clark, hot on the heels of the success of his An Arsonist's Guide to Writers' Homes in New England. A funny tale that takes a headline from the news and throws in a little spy thriller fun. It makes for a rollicking read. Brock Clark, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thanks for having me.
You're coming to town for an appearance at Joseph Beth Booksellers at the Rookwood Pavilion, 7 o'clock on Tuesday evening. Looking forward to coming back to the Queen City?
I am. I miss it. I mean, it's been 4 years now since I left, and it's not like I miss it less. I miss it a lot, so I'm looking forward to it.
I wanted to ask where the inspiration for The Happiest People in the World came from, because I mentioned a rip from the news headlines, the story of the Danish cartoonist who had a cartoon depicting Muhammad that many folks were enraged at. That's kind of the one kernel in The Happiest People in the World, but that's only part of it. Where did the inspiration for the new novel come from?
My wife, I forgot what year it was, but she had work in Copenhagen. She had to go there for work, and so I went with her, and our then-only son went with us to go there. And I never thought about Denmark one way or the other. I mean, I knew that it existed as a country, but I never thought about it as a place I either would like to or would not like to go. It just never even entered my radar, my cultural radar. And when I got there, I absolutely fell in love with it, for reasons that are still kind of inscrutable to me. I fall in love with places that are unlikely, like upstate New York, which is the second part of this answer to this question. But before I get there, I just love Denmark. I love the people. I mean, in some ways, it made me act very non-Brock Clark-like, where the people there are incredibly happy. They're always named the happiest people in the world. And I hate happy people normally, but I really loved how unassumingly happy these people were. And I really didn't want to leave after the 2 weeks we had to leave, and I really didn't want to. And I came home, and I thought about the place a lot. And then at some point in the next year or so, these cartoonists at Yilin's Posten were asked to draw cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad as they saw him. And one of them drew a cartoon with Muhammad with a bomb under his turban, which caused all this controversy, and there were strikes, and there were riots, and assassination attempts. And then I thought, well, not so happy after all, are you? And in part, it was just like a cheap irony for me to explore, but I also thought about how often one person's happiness is predicated on someone else's unhappiness. But mostly I just was really unhappy by the whole thing. I mean, I was unhappy at the cartoonist. I was unhappy with the people who were attacking them. And then I thought, I'm going to send you people, I'm going to write a novel and send you people to a place which is home about the least happy people in the world, which is upstate New York, which is where I'm from. And so I mean, that's really the impetus of the novel. It began as this trip to Denmark, and then it sort of snowballed after that. And I thought, I'm fond of novels, both writing and reading novels that seem to have no chance of working out. And this seemed to be the best example of that kind of book. And I hope it worked out.
More than once, you've referred to upstate New York as being an unhappy place, or one of the a place known for unhappiness. And I was just curious why that is so ingrained in your soul.
Well, because I love it. It's sort of like there's a passage in the novel where, so the novel, this cartoonist goes underground and with the help of the CIA emerges under a different identity as a high school guidance counselor in upstate New York. And in the beginning of that, he's given a tour of the town by Maddie, who's the principal and also a local. He's grown up and lived in the town his entire life. And there's a line, something to the effect of, I know this, in Maddie's internal monologue, he says, I know this place is miserable, but you better not tell me you think that too. And that was always as an adult, I became very defensive about upstate New York because I loved it, even though I recognized that it made a lot of people miserable, and I got very defensive about it. And when I say that's home of the least happy people in the world, in some ways I think that's a kind of badge of honor. I love places which other people have already dismissed out of hand. So this is why I had a tough time moving from Cincinnati to Portland, Maine, where I live now, where I moved there, and this woman who I liked very much, I told her I moved from Cincinnati to Portland. She's like, oh, great. And I just looked at her. She must have seen the look of intense hatred on my face. Then she said, I mean, right? And I think of Cincinnati and upstate New York as some ways similar, at least in my consciousness, where it's a place that other people don't know about, and so they dismiss out of hand, and that makes me love it even more.
I have to say, I've not really spent any time in upstate New York and get quite an indoctrination in the happiest people in the world.
You're welcome, Mark.
So thank you. It sounds like an interesting place, but yes, a place that could be unhappy. Well, and this...
I'm not sure. You know, if you go to upstate New York, I'm not sure that you're going to actually find a lot of CIA agents working in the local diners and high schools. That might just be, you know, my experience.
Let alone more than one, too. Well, what about the spy novel? I mean, was this something you've been wanting to write, to dabble into that spy genre?
No, absolutely not. I don't have a lot of affection for the genre. I do in terms of movies, but not in terms of novels. I don't read spy novels almost ever, except when they're literary spy novels, like Muriel Spark, who is a great model for this book, often writes novels that have these unlikely spy elements, but she has a lot of unlikely elements. So it's not like she's writing a spy novel. She's just writing a novel in which it makes sense to have spies operate. And that's how this came about. I didn't intend to write a novel full of spies, but as I began writing it, I thought, well, this guy, the cartoonist, has to go on the run. And if he's going on the run, he has to be helped by someone. And then I thought, well, who would help him? And so I came up with these secret agents. And then when he came up to New York, I was like, well, why did they bring him here? And I was like, well, there have to be CIA agents here. I mean, there's obviously a level of goofy irony there. This middle-of-nowhere town is home to all these CIA agents in training, but it seemed to me a logical growth in the novel insofar as anything is logical in the novel. I do like novels that take these big leaps, and the agents were a big leap for me, but I had not planned them from the beginning.
The Happiest People in the World, a novel by Brock Clark, available in libraries and bookstores right now. Brock Clark will be in Cincinnati Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock at Joseph Beth Booksellers for a talk and signing. And I wanted to ask, I laughed out loud more than once while reading The Happiest People in the World for a number of reasons, but I was curious about, there's a very tragic side too. I mean, how do you balance that humor and tragedy? You know, as a writer, when you're trying to put together a story like this, balancing that macabre irony that comes about.
Right. I guess my idea about this is one is no good without the other. You know, the humor without the sense of tragedy is just jokey, and the tragedy without the humor is just melodrama. And I found over, you know, whatever, however many years of writing, that if something of mine is going to work, it's going to have both, because it'll feel empty or easy otherwise. There's this great line by this writer, Donald Barthelme, who asked his students, what must wacky modes do? And he then answered his question, and the answer was, they must break our hearts. And I've always tried to follow that. But I also have a kind of maybe the warning fails me sometimes, but I'm often writing something and I realize and become aware that this is about to descend into wackiness, just wackiness for wackiness' sake, and so then I try to rectify that. It's not like a plan, but it's almost an internal reaction to my own worst tendencies. So, yeah, and those are the kind of books I like to read. So I try to replicate the things I like in other people's literature, people's books. Yeah, but it's not anymore. It's not like I have a big plan. It's not like I have an outline on page 25. I said, must get serious here, or must get funny here. The material just sort of dictates it.
Speaking of the material, you have a number of characters and a number of protagonists because, you mentioned the Danish cartoonist who has to go on the run after doing the cartoon that was raised some ire. But
I haven't even explained that, Mark. Yeah, no, I should probably explain that, right? The idea that so this cartoonist draws a cartoon commenting upon the controversy, and then someone burns down his home, and so with the help of these secret agents, he fakes his death and then goes into hiding and emerges with a new identity. I probably didn't say that before. Not that that makes this any more plausible, now that I've explained it. But.
Oh, well,
I cut you off, though.
Well, but I was going to ask, you know, you have it, I think I read somewhere where you said you originally were going to do the entire novel from the perspective of the cartoonist, but really this is a perspective that goes from the cartoonist to the high school principal, Maddie, that you mentioned, to his son, American high school student, to a Danish teenage terrorist. I'm not going to go too much further in that. I don't want to give anything away. But, you know, there's a lot of different perspectives in here. When did you make the transition from just that single voice to all these characters?
I think I probably got 30 or so pages in writing from the cartoonist/guidance counselor's voice in his first person point of view. And then I just felt it was too limited. I was already getting bored with it. And I thought the idea was fantastic, but my approach to it, I was boring even myself, which is usually a terrible sign. And so I began writing, I I tried third person. And then I got to a certain point. Actually, it was very early on in the redrafting of the opening. And then I thought, I put him in contact with another character. And I became very interested in what that character would do next. And what she would do next was not talk to the protagonist. She would then talk to someone else. And so in order to access that conversation, I had to switch point of views. And I had to go into Maddie, the principal's point of view. And then once I started doing that, I realized that this was the way the novel could work. It's about, if it's a novel about a lot of people with a lot of secrets, then the third person, rotating third person point of view would work because the reader would know things that the characters would not. So the reader would be on somewhat in on the secrets and would be an advantage to the characters. And then that's the way the novel would operate, where the characters would only learn certain important things about each other when it was too late. But the reader would be in on the secret the entire time, or at least in on some of the secrets. And I thought that would be an interesting source of friction for the novel. But you're right, and at the beginning, at the outset, this was a first-person novel, and I was so glad I gave up on that because it would have been terrible.
I have to ask you about your fascination with fire, Brock. Let me see, we had an arsonist guide to writers' homes in New England, a little arson happening in The Happiest People in the World, too. What's up with you and arson?
In three of my other four books, there's arson also. I don't have, you know, it's just a dramatic event that you can't then forget. I have no issue with fire whatsoever, I swear. I'm not a firebug. I've never been a firebug. But I'm attracted to these big events that then change everything in novels. And for me, maybe it's just kind of a cheap trick, but these fires actually then serve as catalysts for the rest of the novel. It's also true that when I was a kid in my hometown, there was a fire. And that fire, a racially charged fire, and that fire sort of stuck in my imagination as something that was both profound and also mysterious. And I guess I just keep coming back to it. The next one, I swear, there will be no fire at all.
Are you sure?
It'll be like something really undramatic, like egging. Like someone's house will get egged. That'll be the big event. No houses will be burned, but something will be egged.
A number of times I ran across the stream of conscious, I guess you could say narratives, these sentences that go on and on, comma after comma after comma, that go on for a page and a half, almost 2 pages at times, all strung together from the mind of the character. And I was wondering if those come out in one fell swoop, or are those long sentences and all those phrases linked together something you have to go back and refine and refine and refine?
I wrote one early on. It's one at a baseball game. That was an early chapter, even though the chapter now falls in the middle of the novel. And I thought it was really effective. I mean, I rarely have fun writing, but I had fun writing that section in which a guy, the cartoonist / guidance counselor, is looking at Maddie, who's an umpire at a student faculty baseball game, and it's on the eve of the guidance counselor marrying Maddie's ex-wife. And so it's the guidance counselor looking at Maddie and imagining what Maddie is thinking. And I thought, as long as I didn't overdo it, what a perfect way to emphasize how frantic not knowing exactly what the other person is thinking. What a great way to dramatize that. And I try to give that to each of the main characters, a moment where they both had this sort of like panicky, long internal monologue to show exactly how lost they were. And I thought, as long as I didn't overuse that, I used it maybe once for each character, the reader would get a sense of exactly what that character wanted and how he or she probably wasn't going to get it. But yeah, no, I rarely write like that. I don't think I've ever written like that in any other novel or short story. But once I did the first one, I realized that this would be useful for the novel. And I think some of them they run the gamut, I hope, from being very funny to being really desperate, which is a combination I like.
Oh, well, they do. I mean, you hear that internal dialogue and that internal argument that's going on as well. The Happiest People in the World, a novel by Brock Clark, available in bookstores and libraries now. You can find out more about it at WVXU.org, and you can see Brock in person. Brock Clark will be at Joseph F. Booksellers in Rookwood Pavilion Tuesday at 7 o'clock. That's Tuesday, November 18th. Information about that on our website, WVXU.org, as well. So Brock Clark, author of The Happiest People in the World, what are you reading?
I'm reading this book called Woke Up Lonely by Fiona Mazel. I just started it yesterday on the plane ride down here to New York City, and it's about this sort of quasi-religious organization called The Helix, and the leader / prophet of this group is in love with a secret agent. He knows she's a secret agent, but not how that she's following him, that he's part of her beat. And it's a novel that has sort of exponentially exploding secrets. And each chapter, at least as far as I've gotten, which is about 100 pages into the book, each chapter you know a little bit more about what each character is hiding from each other. And it's a great, great, really funny, really wild and broad exploration of how we're constantly eavesdropping into each other's lives and only sort of half understanding what we want from the eavesdropping, what we hope to come out of it. And it's also terrifically, terrifically funny. It's one of the funniest books I've read in a long time. So far, I'm totally in love with it.
Brock Clark, again at Joseph Beth on Tuesday. Find out more at WVXU.org. It's the Book Club at 91.7. You've been listening to the Book Club at 91.7. The club's producer is Kevin Reynolds. Technical director is Bruce Ellis. Rick Andres is music director and segment engineer. The club's web guru, Jim Nolan. And Robin Carey Allgaier is the announcer. Robin, what are you reading?
I'm currently going back and forth between two books. One is Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides, which is a lot to get through, but it's really fascinating. And it's a novel that he won the Pulitzer Prize for in 2002. And I'm also reading The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. And it's also the subtitle, A Guide to Spiritual Enlightenment. But a neighbor of mine gave it to me and said it was just life-changing for her. And it is quite intriguing.
Thanks, Robin. And I'm Mark Purcell. Thanks for listening to the Book Club at 91.7. Quite a story to share next time. Piper Hawkins will be here to tell you how the Books by the Banks Book Festival inspired her to start a Kickstarter campaign so she could publish her first book. As the snowflakes fly and the holidays approach, her book, Visions of Light, A Christmas Story, is in bookstores. Piper and I sit down for a chat next Saturday morning on the Book Club at 91.7. Oh, by the way, Piper's 9 years old. Weekend edition coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. Have a great Saturday.